listening to the Tennis.com podcast. And here's your host, Ed McGrogan.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Tennis.com podcast. Once again, I'm Ed McGrogan here catching up with Steve Tigner on the latest on both the ATP and WTA tours. Steve, this week I again want to start with the women's game. We got into Fed Cup a lot, one of our last podcasts. This time in February, as we gradually make our way toward March and the bigger hard court events, women certainly take center stage this week in Dubai. The men will have their tournament there next week, and we'll just get into that a little bit after. But the women have their strong field in Dubai this week. It would have been even stronger if we didn't have a couple of late pullouts with Serena and Bouchard, but in this event, you get a very strong roster either way. But the way it's turned out has been, you know, very unlike what you might expect from such, you know, such an event like this. The top half of the draw as of right now, you know, Halep and Wozniacki end up at the end. And the bottom half of the draw is pretty much complete carnage, with the two semifinals being Muguruza, who we definitely want to talk about, and Karolina Pliskova, who's actually seeded 17th, but only because one of the top 16 seeds pulled out. So it's a tournament where, you know, we're seeing, I think, as you put it to me, really the depth of, how do you want to really phrase it as to what this, you know, means, or how this shows really the WTA at this particular time?
I think you can look at it, you know, outside of Serena and Maria, outside of Serena Williams and Maria Sharapova, the two finalists in Australia, it just seems like there is a lot of depth, and it feels like anybody can beat anybody somewhere in the top 20 or so. It's not really surprising, you know. Say Radwanska was the fifth seed and Muguruza was unseeded, and Muguruza won 6-4, 6-2. That still, to me, isn't a shocking loss, and somebody like Pliskova could end up in the semifinals. Somebody like Safarova could beat Venus Williams. Somebody like Panetta could beat Kerber. Those are upsets, but they're not shockers. It sort of seems to me that there's a solid 20 players on the WTA below Serena and Maria, where you feel like anybody can beat anybody. It's just sort of a tour in flux all the time.
Yeah, and that's interesting to say when you consider that one of those players amongst that group seems to be still Petra Kvitova, who is now a two-time Wimbledon champion, but is a player that I think we just continually wait for to really elevate herself, not to the level of Serena, of course, but to a distinct other tier, you know, above the rest of the fray here. And it just, we're still waiting for outside of grass. And, you know, it is, I think, a little bit disappointing in some ways to just know that the talent, the obvious sort of jaw-dropping talent on her best day is there, but we just don't see enough of those best days.
Yeah, she came into this tournament the second seed. You know, I think both you and I thought that she was looking like she would have a pretty big year this year, and it's obviously still possible. But an early loss in Australia, now she loses to Suarez Navarro in Dubai. And I think she's made an effort to get fit. In watching her, she looks much fitter, but a little more, maybe a little, is hitting a not quite as big as she has been in the past. I don't know if that's a trade-off she's trying for. That's just something, you know, maybe that's just temporary. Maybe that's just a couple times I've seen her. She hasn't looked quite as overwhelming as ball striking. But you know, maybe it's just her career will always be these ups and downs, these sort of sharp turns. Both of her matches in Dubai were three sets. But it is, after the beginning of the year and after Wimbledon last year, it's still a little surprising, like you said, giving her talent, that she would go sort of retreat again, at least to me.
Yeah. You know, when you look at this tournament here, you actually see, I feel like it's a 2020 hindsight thing, but you look and it's loaded with these, you know, players that we see at Grand Slam tournaments that kind of throw wrenches in the plans and really disrupt draws. You know, Safarova, Carlos Suarez Navarro, who you mentioned, or we mentioned, you know, also Makarova, Panetta. These are, you know, veteran players who have just, who really won't, do not relent and often cause high seeds a lot of trouble. So I certainly don't want to discount really the abilities of these really this latest string of really minor upsets, I think is a good way to put it, and perhaps not even upsets at all, as we say. One player who I think is worth elaborating on a little more is Muguruza, who, as you said, beat Radwanska early on. She also beat, really had her way with Yelena Yankovic 3-1, goes on to beat Radwanska. Earlier this year in Australia, we saw Muguruza nearly defeat Serena Williams again at a Grand Slam. And when she, I have to say, certainly one of the most entertaining WTA players to watch when, certainly when things are landing for her, because it's a forehand that is kind of a whip crack shot that really, I think, catches even her opponents still off guard. It's really one of the best in the game, and she will not be unseated for much longer, I don't think, at these events. And I think it's a pretty good path that she's on right now.
Yeah, you know, we saw her. She looked like she was going to be a top 10 player a few years ago. Then she got hurt last year. Obviously, she had a big start to the year, beat Serena at the French, and then, faded a little. She seems to have come back to that level again of where she was. So I think you look at her as somebody who's going to be challenging again, at least through the first half of the year. Maybe that's her pattern. She's a fast starter. The other person to look at in this tournament is Karolina Pliskova. She beat Ivanovic. She beat Safarova. As we're talking, she's playing Muguruza. And she's sort of been the big mover of the season so far into the top 20. She has a nice game, easy power, good hands. She's tall, has a good service motion. I think that's somebody, it's a little bit of a surprise for the year, but looking like at the moment, like somebody who's going to, is for real, we're going to see a lot more of.
Yeah. It's been another, steady, little more than steady rise, as you say, up the rankings for Pliskov there. At the top, like I said, this match will be decided by the time you're listening to this, of course, but Halep and Wozniacki, two players who, after the Australian Open, really quicker than expected Aussie Open exits there for both. It's a tough, it's a little bit of a catch-22, I think, for them in a way, in that really the proof for them doesn't really come out until the biggest events, because they are obviously such established players, and really we're kind of waiting to see, are both of them really ready to assume that next step? Both of them are in very different place in their career, both around the same age, but you have someone who in Halep, got off to such a strong start last year. Wozniacki really turned it on at the end there, but to me, it's really more that I'm curious to see what either of those two end up doing, in March, but really more so, until we get to the biggest titles.
Yeah, I think Halep is a good sign at this tournament. She played the woman she lost to in Australia, Ekaterina Makarova. They had a good match, a three-set match. In Australia, Halep just kind of went away in the second set, really didn't even look like she wanted to be there. This match, she fought through it.
She also went away in the second set.
She went away in the second set, yeah. This time, but came back and really showed a good effort to win. And she said afterwards that she felt like because she didn't fight in that match in Australia, she really wanted to do that this time. So that's, that in a way is a good sign. And Wozniacki, I've just been amazed about how Wozniacki is just, since the middle of last year, has just sort of resumed where she was moving up the ranks well into the top 10, just sort of gone back to where she was. She had dropped down and now, you know, very fast turnaround. And is, she had an early loss at, in Australia, but that was to Azarenka, so that wasn't that bad. Here she is in the semis, and you know, you figure she's going to be back challenging for slams again. It didn't really take very long.
No, I think we already kind of just have put her back in that place amongst the game, and it's one of the better stories for sure. Considering, I think, you know, how high the or how big the fall seemed to be from number one to you know, really not that far outside of the top 10, but it just seems so precipitous because it seemed that really the game had almost passed her by in the span of about a year or two, and really it's kind of been a little bit of a resurrection at, you know, I think 23, I can't recall her age, but it's, you know, really so much time left for her to really make good on, you know, what many have predicted for her for many years. So, you know, that's where I think we'll leave things for the women in Dubai. The men get their turn next week. It's pretty interesting, actually, now that I think about it, is that this would kind of make an ideal, you know, dual event. The tours have, you know, gone so much to try and get as many combined events as possible, and I mention it especially because Novak Djokovic did talk about how the desire to see Dubai become a Masters tournament, and thinking about it there that way. But there are some practical points of why they perhaps may not even want to do that. It's, you know, the high appearance fees that draw these big fields. You know, that kind of is eliminated if you take on really the status and really more rigorous requirements that an event demands. I mean, do you think that, especially with the tours going so much more toward the east, and you know, we have obviously some very high quality Middle Eastern tournaments, if that would ever be a reality to what Djokovic was saying?
Yeah, it would make a great Masters event, a great dual gender Masters event. Obviously, it's a high profile place. It already has, it's sort of built through these appearance fees over the years, built a little tradition with tennis. Doesn't have, doesn't have the greatest fan support, but good. I think it's, you know, people associate it with tennis, and it would be a great way to fill February, which is a sort of a you know, not a very, there's not a lot at stake in February. It would give this month something, you know, it would give it that. I don't know what the logistics are of putting a tournament like that together. Like you said, maybe it's, be careful what you wish for the top players. They wouldn't be paid any longer to go there.
Yes.
But I think for fans who are looking for something in this month, you know, it seems like a, so, you know,
it is the most significant event of the month anyway. It always seems that we put it that way. And, you know, many of the players, are pretty much de facto residents of the area, including Roger Federer, you know, him, Djokovic, Andy Murray also will be playing next week along with, you know, this is only a 32-player event. Next week, so it's a much tighter field for the men's draw, but it's, I think, a little more quality over quantity.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting. Federer, Djokovic, Murray. We've seen Murray once since the Australian in Rotterdam. First time we're going to see Djokovic and Federer. First time we're going to see Federer since his third round loss in Australia, which, you know, feels like a couple months ago. Last year, Federer beat Djokovic at this tournament. You know, I think as far as people having things on the line, I think probably Federer is the person who could use the good result at the moment. Djokovic, whatever happens to him, he has the Australian already. Murray is obviously nobody. I don't know if anybody's expecting Murray to win the tournament. But Federer, to me, after his loss in Australia, I'm not sure what to make of his. Just be interesting to see what happens with him going forward. Obviously, overall, his trajectory has been good. He's number two in the world. He had a good season last year, but I almost feel like that's the kind of loss that could end his momentum in a way.
It was certainly, I think, you know, to go along the lines of what you're saying, it was one of his more, you know, unexpected. I don't think anybody saw that coming for a variety of reasons, and especially because, you know, he had just won the week before in Brisbane, and really at that point had seemed to put what happened at the end of last year kind of, you know, really completely behind him.
Yeah, well, I mean, it sort of reminds me, possibly in 2012 he had a good year. He came back to number one, and then he lost to Burdich at the U.S. Open, and he sort of reacted a little negatively to it afterwards. I was surprised, and I felt like that sort of stopped his momentum that time, and he struggled for a while. He obviously was injured in 2013, and there were other factors, but I just wonder whether, you know, we'll see whether he can, whether at this point he had, you know, he can sort of bounce back quickly from a bad loss. So that'll be an interesting aspect of this tournament.
Yeah, that's a good point on Roy Federer as a momentum player. Something I don't think we've had to think about, especially, you know, considering in the early parts, you know, in the prime of Federer, really the many years of his career, it's, you know, if he took a loss, it's more that you can suspect, and for with great reason, that it was really just a one-off showing. But that, you know, that has happened more frequently, of course. Federer has aged, and the field has really improved around him. But the momentum aspect of Federer, and really when you think about it, kind of all of the you know, the big four players who have become increasingly more threatened over the years, I think that's perhaps a little more an underrated element of where they are at the moment, because we do now have Murray, Nadal, Federer, Djokovic back in those top four slots, and it's still really a point of debate, I think, of where people view this collective quartet here as their, you know, as how strong of rulers they are in the game, and you know how they are able to be beaten, and I think it's not out of the line to say that the vulnerability really is still there, but you know, now we are back to seeing that clear delineation point between those four guys and the rest of the field. You know, I mentioned that in part because of, you know, players that are playing now and next week. You know, Rafa, he's back this week in Rio. At the moment, he's into the quarterfinals after two straight sets wins. You know, he comes back onto clay, and you talk about momentum with Rafa. You know, really his career has been built on that, you know, especially on clay, where he just piles up wins, you know, just gobbles them up. But, you know, so what do you, you know, Rui, what do you say or kind of see Rafa at right now? Because, you know, obviously when you talk about people who are in different points of their career, you know, Rafa seems to have a new stage of his career every couple of years, it seems like.
Yeah, I feel like now he has a new sort of, he has a new template for making his comebacks. In 2013, he played the South American Tour for the first time in a long time, won a couple tournaments, and then he had maybe his best year of his career. Now he seems to be trying that again. He's playing in Rio, and he's going to play in Buenos Aires next week. I feel like Rafa we know he's the best clay court male player ever, but I think one thing he's also done well with it is he's used his dominance on that surface as a way to build confidence for other surfaces. He's always had that big spring on clay, and it used to feed into Wimbledon, where he eventually won. I feel like this is a way he's trying to sort of to expand that idea by starting the year on clay essentially, and sort of building out into the two big U.S. hardcourt tournaments in the spring. It's another way for him to kind of use his strength, which I think is something. I don't know if any other player, there have been clay court specialists, grass court specialists, but I don't know if any other player has used his ability on one surface, I feel like, to build confidence on other surfaces as well as Rafa. And that would make sense because he's so dominant on the one on the one surface.
Yeah, well, what's interesting to me with Rafa is that it really speaks to this time of the year where we're kind of this February month where you don't really have a big beacon event that centers around. But you know, in the past, you know, Rafa was, you know, he's always been, of course, you know, the best on clay, but you know, at this stage of the year, he was never, you know, he was never playing events in the South American Swing, for example. There always have been a number of clay court events there, but that was really left to, I think, the dyed-in-the-wool, just dirtball diehards there. And Rafa, you know, bided his time and really just only sort of took ownership of the surface, you know, on the big European events there. And and it's, I have to say, it's you know, when you think back to say like you know, 2007, 2008, and you're like, oh, it would be something to see Rafa, you know, in these really smaller events. And you know, now we're seeing it, and they're, you know, they're actually, you know, they are certainly giving, you know, he's winning, but they, you know, they've become, I think, pretty critical, important events of his schedule of late. And you know, that's a little more interesting in that we'll see the Olympics down there in 2016 as well. Of course, not on clay, but to see Rafa really sort of change his, you know, his schedule evolve over time, I think, you know, will make yet another chapter and really, you know, his story when all is said and done. And you know, to me, that's one little more interesting wrinkle of this February month, is that Rafa has become a big part of it in a different way. So, you know, one other player that I wanted to mention, looking at this Dubai event next week, is actually Thomas Berdych, because just thinking back, you know, thinking back to things that seemed to happen a little while ago, you know, Berdych's run to the Aussie Open, through the Aussie Open, that seems like a while ago. Of course, he took out Nadal, but he really went down pretty surprisingly in some ways to Djokovic there, at the end there. But I think this is a big event for Berdych, coming off that result, and really, you know, was that just another kind of surge by him, or can he sustain that and really make this renaissance that perhaps we saw from Stan Wawrinka a couple of years ago?
Yeah, Berdych, he did the same thing in Rotterdam. I felt like in one match, in the way he did in Australia, he, like you said, he beat Rafa in Australia and then kind of reverted to form and lost in the key moments to Murray in the Rotterdam final. He's lost a lot of matches recently to Wawrinka. He played Wawrinka again, was ahead, looked like this was the match he was going to win, was hitting really cleanly, was hitting the same way he had against Nadal in Australia, and then he couldn't finish it. You know, Wawrinka was almost the better, you know, was again the better competitor. And I think that's still there for Berdych. He seems to be hitting the ball really well. As far as just ball striking, he seems more confident, I feel like, than he's ever been. But just getting down to winning those matches that he doesn't normally win, he's lost a bunch. You know, he lost a bunch to Wawrinka, and that's what happened. You know, it sort of, you know, it almost felt like, well, now I have to beat this guy I haven't beaten, and he couldn't do it. And that's been his pattern in the past. So that's the one. You know, I still feel like there's that same issue for him that he'll need to get over. It'll be tough at this tournament, obviously, with Federer, Djokovic, and Murray, three guys who really are ahead of him. It would be an impressive win if he could beat a couple of those guys.
Yeah, I think, you know, with the structure of the tournament, he's going to be forced to play a number of those guys in a row. And but if it, I mean, that's what I think I say when I think about Berdych, and maybe this term means most to a guy like him of all of them, because it would perhaps be one of the most impressive of, you know, of his career to this point, and we see him in perhaps a bit of a new light as things have progressed from 2015 on for him. So I think that's when we will catch up again, is in the midst of the men's event in Dubai. And until that next time, everyone, thank you for listening to the Tennis.com podcast. I'm Ed McGrogan with Steve Tickner.
You've been enjoying the Tennis.com podcast. For all the latest news and events, head over to tennis.com.